there's not a risk of serious injury or death, they don't seem to be real interested in participating. Seems to me like what X Games is all about, or anything associated with Red Bull. Those folks are crazy. They're crazy. The college students used to joke with me about always passing out liability waivers for them to sign on any trip that we made. It seemed like we'd always go do risky stuff, or they would do it, and I would watch from the ground. But there are risks all around us. You can't get away from taking a risk. 4,000 of us seriously injure ourselves every year on our pillow. 200 homes every year catch fire from Christmas trees. You're trying to be festive, and then things go up in flames. I mean, how did that happen? In a four-year period, over 70,000 people were injured using exercise equipment, primarily a treadmill. It's crazy to think, you know, we're out there trying to get fit or stay fit, and a treadmill takes you out. How many of you guys have been taken out by a treadmill? Yeah, it's embarrassing, especially in like a gym. Not that I would know anything about that, but it hurts, and you want to make sure everybody thinks that you did it on purpose. Trampoline, the dreaded trampoline, the source of 240,000 injuries per year. I used to feel like a terrible parent when I would take the kids to the pediatrician because the pediatrician would always ask Zach or Jenna the question, do you have a trampoline? And they would say, well, yes. The next question was, do you wear a bike helmet? And they would all say, no. And I really did love them, but the doctor never seemed to ask the right questions for me to prove that, you know? Maybe the most dangerous object in our home is not what you'd expect. I'm talking about the reclining, cushion, foot resting, relaxation nexus known as the Lazy Boy. We don't call them challenge chairs or adventure chairs. We buy them for one reason, comfort. Now imagine putting on your stretchy pants and your baggy sweatshirt and breaking out your favorite comfort food, whatever it is, maybe Oreos and milk, and you sprawl out in your Lazy Boy with the lights low and the cookies at your side and the remote in hand. Now let me ask you a couple of questions while you're laying there. Do you feel ready to spring into action? While you're laying there, are you poised for an explosion of spiritual growth and development? And while you're laying there, are you on the verge of just waiting for the next mission God puts on your plate? The danger this chair holds is not what you do while you're in it, but what you don't do. The relationships you never deepen. The people you never serve that are in need. The races you never run and the battles you never fight. The adventures you never take, the laughs you miss out on, the tears you don't weep. You are made for something more than life in the chair. Larry Walker had a different idea of what he'd like to do in his chair. You may have remembered hearing this story before. Larry hitched up 45 weather balloons filled with helium. He attached them to his lawn chair, strapped himself in with a couple of sandwiches on board. He grabbed a pellet gun and a six-pack of beer. If that tells you anything. His plan was to hover about 30 feet or so above his backyard and then shoot the balloons so that he could kind of come slowly back down to earth. But with 45 weather balloons filled with helium, you don't settle in at 30 feet. When his friends cut the cord, Larry did not level off at 30 feet or 100 feet or 1,000 feet. He climbed to 16,000 feet with a six-pack of beer and his sandwiches. And he drifted across LAX airspace, because this happens in California, you know. Well, after several hours, he decided to shoot a few balloons and eventually got tangled in some electrical wires. But the FAA spokesperson said, "We know he broke some part of the Federal Aviation Act, and as soon as we figure out which part it is, a charge will be filed." And as they led Larry away in handcuffs, a reporter asked him, "Why'd he do it?" And he said, "A man can't just sit there." So I don't know how you feel about sitting here this morning. So you probably should know this. There is some risk in coming here. If you're a believer in Jesus, there's a risk you'll be convicted of some issue in your life you'd rather ignore. You might be challenged to alter an area of your life or way of thinking which you've grown accustomed to. Your comfortable lifestyle might be disrupted by some challenging and tough questions. And I wonder how many of us come here on Sunday morning actually expecting something to happen, because coming here is a little risky. God just might show up. And if you're not a believer, there's a risk for you too. The risk is you might be confronted with some information, some insight that forces you to ask yourself, what will I do with God? What does it mean to choose to believe? What about this man called Jesus? Is he really something special? So there are a few risks lurking in here today, and maybe that's why we engage in some of our own risk management. We do our best to look nice. We smile at each other. We say the right things. We give an appearance of being interested, but the last thing on our minds is allowing someone in on our secrets or our shame or our pain or our battles. That would be too risky. And we certainly don't want God messing with our lives. So maybe that's why we're here. In our deluded attempt to manage risk, we think if we come to church and we drop in a few bucks and endure the ceremony, God will see that we're on his side, but what we hope is that he leaves us alone the rest of the week. We're very content sitting the bench on Sunday rather than be put in the game on Monday. After all, no one should be fanatical. Everything is better in what? Moderation. And what we're after is a little bit of Jesus to round out our lives. Well, the parable we're going to look at today is found in Matthew 25. Leading up to Matthew 25 is, surprisingly, Matthew 24. And Jesus has been teaching his followers, and they ask him this question. They ask him, how will we know when you're coming back? Are there any signs to let us know that your return is near? Now, people in our day have made a lot of money on seminars and movies and especially books in an attempt to answer this question. And Jesus does give them a couple of ideas to chew on, but his summary statement is found in verse 42. He says this, therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time the night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let the house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. That's Jesus' main point. Don't get so caught up in trying to read the signs of the times. Don't try to count the number of earthquakes or stare at the sky or just stop trying to decode the conflict in the Middle East with some apocalyptic code breaker. I was thinking about this. If you definitely don't want Jesus to return tomorrow, I think you should make a bold prediction that he's coming back tomorrow based on some signs of the time, and that way he's certain not to return since you predicted it. You know, that kind of makes sense to me. I checked out Wikipedia to see the number of the end of the world predictions which have been made. And I'm sure these are just the most prominent predictions, but so far there have been 174 that Wikipedia has presented. And here's a note I thought was interesting. I don't know who Ronald Wineland is, never heard of the guy, but he predicted the world would end on June 9th, 2019. Mr. Wineland previously predicted the world would end in 2011, 2012, and 2013, and then he predicted in 2018, this June 19th thing, but prior to the date occurring of June 19th, he began to express some doubts regarding his own prediction, which, because he hadn't been right yet. You know, do you know what Jesus' point is? It's pretty easy. Just be ready all the time, because Jesus will return when you least expect him. From here, Jesus tells a couple of parables, and he uses these stories to drive home his point. When we get to chapter 25, Jesus tells a story that, to be honest, if I can say this, I really don't like it. Check out verse 14 and 15 and verse 25. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. We don't know much about this guy who's going on a trip except that he had some servants. And considering the amount of money in this story, he seems to be a fairly wealthy guy. We don't know where he went nor why he left. All we know is he went on a trip, he left some of his assets in the hands of a few servants. It's not their money. They're just given responsibility to take care of it. They were stewards or managers of the money. just to let you understand the dynamic here, this is a substantial thing that he leaves them. A talent was worth about $1,000. It was probably a unit of silver. And that talent of silver, that $1,000, was worth a 2.5 years' salary for these workers. So it's a lot of money. And he picked three of the servants he thought he could trust, gave them maybe the password to his account, and then he goes on his journey. Verse 16, see what happens. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more, but the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. And his master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. The master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. So you notice both of these guys received the same affirmation, I mean, word for word, exactly. They didn't start with the same amount. They didn't finish with the same amount, but they received the same words of blessing. Then we come to the third guy. Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here's what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you know that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the banker so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him. Give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think I mentioned I don't really like this story. I don't like the way these guys start with different amounts. Being the math guy, I would have preferred to see the talents divided into 3 equal parts, you know, and each of them given $2,666.66, and maybe, you know, tip the chariot driver with any left. That would have been the fair thing to do, but Jesus isn't into being fair. So one gets $5,000, one gets $2,000, one gets $1,000. But that sounds a lot more like reality, doesn't it? We don't all start out the same. And I want to stop here for a moment because I think this is an important thought to seriously consider. And some of us miss this point. I started out my life with 2 parents who loved me, a father who made sufficient income to provide for all of my needs, a mother who cared for me, fixed me 3 meals a day. I never went hungry. I never worried about the stability of the home I slept safely in every night. There were no fear of gunshots, gang violence, no drug activity. I had people who believed in me and supported me and wisely guided me. I had a network of people watching out for me wherever I went growing up. When it was time for college, I was ready for college. The time came, I went, my tuition was paid for. You know, that's a pretty good start. And to top it off, I married a beautiful, bright, capable young woman who had all the same experiences I had. Everyone doesn't have that kind of start. I was born on third base while others were never taught how to even throw or catch a ball. So I don't like that part about this story. I also don't like seeing the rich get richer. I would like to have seen the underdog win, the 1 talent guy. We root against the powerhouses, the stacked teams, the huge corporate conglomerates. Who doesn't love to see the Yankees or the Patriots lose? You know, people outside the SEC talk about Alabama fatigue. They've been too good for too long. It's probably the same way about UK basketball. We root for the little giants, the Mighty Ducks, Rudy, the Bad News Bears. We cheered until we were hoarse in 1980 at the U.S. Olympic hockey team when they beat the reigning 4-time Olympic champions from Russia, the bad guys, you know. The Miracle on Ice. There aren't many underdog stories better than that one. And we love stories like that. But that's not the trajectory of this parable. In this parable, the guy with the five talents, the richest guy in the story, hits it big on Microsoft stocks, and he sells at his peak. And I don't like the way the boss in this story doesn't seem to leave any instructions as to what to do. Does that bother you as you look at this parable? He hands them the money, and then he rides off into the sunset. He doesn't spell out any expectations. There are no suggestions given, no boundaries, no standard, no idea of an impending performance review. He just simply goes on his journey. Maybe you've worked for a boss like that. They come back from wherever they went, and they rip into you because you didn't do what you were supposed to do, even though you didn't know. No grace, no slack. In fact, the boss in Jesus' story is so aggressive that he takes the money from the guy who has the least and he gives it to, guess who? The guy with the most, so the rich get richer. Now, how fair is that? I don't like that part of the story either. And then the boss gives him the boot. And where do you suppose he boots him? Where do you think this place is where teeth are gnashed and people weep? It sounds to me like he sends this guy to hell. And I don't like that part of the story either. And even though I don't like the story, I need to hear it. And I want to see where I fit in, because it's a parable Jesus intentionally chooses to tell. And there must be an important lesson in here for you and me. Plus, it's a story he tells toward the end of his time with his followers. And I don't know, we tend to say important things at farewells, it seems like. So in this story, he tells about what ought to be going on in the lives of people who claim to follow him. God has entrusted us with some things. We are his servants. We are stewards. And someday we're going to stand before him and talk to him about what we did with what he gave us. Or maybe the point needs to be refined a bit more than that. You know, why did this guy with the one talent get the boot? Was it because he was unproductive? I mean, is this a parable about what we produce? Is it about what we accomplish? Or could the point be more about gratitude and about trying to do something, anything, just anything with what we've been given? The problem with the last guy is that he did nothing with what he was given, and the master called him what? Lazy. I wish there was a fourth guy in this story, a fourth servant. A guy who was given one talent, let's say, and let's suppose that he invested that one talent in a losing proposition. He took a risk, he did something, and he lost it all. What would the master have said to a guy like that, a guy who was grateful for the responsibility, a guy who tried to do something with the money, but it just didn't work out? Would he have heard the same condemning sentence that the last guy heard? After all, he wasn't lazy, and he wasn't wicked. He could have just been unlucky at best and unwise at worst. I mean, have you ever lost money in an investment? I remember probably the mid-80s, I invested a couple of $1,000s in a church bond. And you'd think a church would honor their debts, but they defaulted. I think I got back about 5% on that investment. But you know, you do the research, you counsel with experts, you wait for the right time, and yet you still lose. Every investment is not a winner, no matter how careful you might be. But what if there had been a guy like that in the parable? What would the master of the house said to him? The point of the story is not whoever produces the most gets the greatest reward. That would be inconsistent with Jesus' teaching in other places, like in Matthew 20, the workers in the vineyard. You may remember that parable. In that parable, the guy who worked the least got paid the same as those who worked all day. And that really hacked off some folks in that story. But this is a story about our response to being honored and trusted with gifts and abilities. Just think back over the last 3 or 4 days. Think about your time. Think about your money and your talents and your abilities. What have you done to honor God with those things just in the past few days? There are reasons why this one talent man failed. And I think we can relate to these because it's the same reason we fail as stewards. The first one is this: we fail when safety first is the best option for us. This guy went out and buried his money in the backyard. So when the master shows up, he goes out back, he digs it up, and he says, "It's a little dirty, but here's your money. I didn't blow it, I didn't lose it, I didn't waste it. In fact, I kept it safe for you. Here you go." This guy took absolutely no risk. Now, you may think you don't have to worry about failure if you don't put anything at risk. This guy's idea of being a good steward was to play it safe and wait. Maybe he was waiting. Maybe he was waiting for the right time or the right opportunity or the right investment. Maybe he was waiting for no chance of failure. Maybe he was waiting for a sure thing. And we wait. We wait with the gifts that we have been given, don't we? We wait for the kids to be grown. We wait for our careers to get on track. We wait to get married. We wait to graduate, waiting to see what others are doing. We wait to see what others might think. We're waiting to know more. But then the master shows up while we're waiting. Jesus says one way to be a failure isn't tied to messing up. All you have to do to fail is nothing. Bobby just read this verse from 1 Peter 4:10, and you can look at it on the screen, but you see that God has given every Christian, every one of us, gifts. And we're all different, but we're all gifted. You have moments, and you have time, and money, and abilities, and you have opportunity. What are you doing on behalf of the Master with what he's given you? You know, what I hear people say is, "I'm not that gifted. I don't have much money. I'm too busy. I'm not ready." And the pronoun in all of those statements is what? It's I. Where is God in those excuses? Where's the power of the Holy Spirit in those statements? It's not about what we do. It's about that we do. It's about being who we were made to be in the name of Jesus. Another reason we fail as stewards is that too often we take the path of least resistance. We decide easier is better. The master called this last servant lazy. He lacked ambition. He lacked effort. He was content to just kind of float through life, to let somebody else do it. And maybe you thought that around here. Just let somebody else do it. Okay, so you let somebody else do this task today. Still, the question is, what are you going to do today? What are you doing for the kingdom with what you've been given? And I'm not necessarily talking about church jobs, you know, teaching children's classes or helping to clean something around here or pull weeds or go on a mission trip or go into a baby shower. I mean, those may be things that you're gifted to do. I'm talking about how you serve people on Monday through the week. It's easy to do that in here, but it's harder on Monday. I'm talking about having a kingdom influence in the marketplace, letting people know that you're a follower of Jesus, serving people in unexpected ways for the glory of God, using your unique gifts to do those kind of things. So, you know, be honest. Are you uninvolved because you're lazy? Are your excuses a mask for being a slug? And only you can answer that. Only you know the truth. The last reason I want to mention that we fail as stewards is because fear becomes our only choice. Fear has stopped too many good things from happening. It stops churches. It stops corporations. It stops families. It stops me. It stops you. Fear stops us from being someone God wants us to be. Fear stops us from following God's lead into new and even risky adventures. Fear stops us from putting in a good word for Jesus where we work. Fear stops us from confronting sin and from holding each other accountable. Fear leads us to say yes to things we shouldn't do, to buy things we can't afford, to agree with people we don't really agree with. Fear has many voices. What will others think? We've never done it this way before. What if we fail? We're not ready. I'm not enough. Fear is a powerful force in our lives and in our church. So the question is, what would you do for God if you weren't afraid? Well, who would you be for God if you weren't afraid? How would you spend your time and your gifts and your abilities if you weren't afraid? Afraid of what others think, afraid of succeeding, afraid of failing. Fear, laziness, safety first lifestyle could easily lead us to be running mates with this one talent guy. I don't honestly meet many people who want or plan to live that way. As I was working through this, there was a commercial that came to my mind, which I remembered. I didn't realize it was so long ago, but I think it was 99 when this commercial was put out. And I think it's worth watching for the next 30 seconds because it's relevant to what we're thinking about this morning. It's a Monster.com commercial entitled, When I Grow Up. Let's run that. Nobody wants to live out that commercial. Nobody. I believe most of us want more out of life. We want to do more. We want to be more with what we've been given. The movie Pearl Harbor, it's an older movie, tells the story of two friends. Their names are Rafe and Danny, and they survive the attack on Pearl Harbor, and they enter World War II as fighter pilots. Well, in their training before the war, Rafe emerges as one of America's top pilots, and when America initially holds back from entering the war, Rafe volunteers to fight with the British against the Germans. So when Rafe first arrives at this English airfield, he walks by the British airman who has been shot up from the previous day's battle. I mean, his plane has got bullet holes all through it, and he's greeted by the commander of this British squadron. And as the commander shows him the plane he's going to fly, a messenger announces to the commander that two more British planes have just been shot down, and the commander turns to Rafe, and he asks, "Are all Yanks as anxious as you to get themselves killed?" And Rafe does not hesitate. He says, "I'm not anxious to die, sir, just anxious to matter." And I wonder if that's how you feel. You know, do you desire to leave a lasting mark on people? I mean, just imagine how tragic it would be to live and die and it just never really mattered. Imagine being busy all your life but having nothing to give back to the master when he returns. Not even a story of risk where you lost it all, perhaps. God has given us each gifts and abilities and time and opportunities and interests and desires and passions so that we can make a difference, so that your life will matter all to his glory. So are you anxious to matter? Will you make a commitment to do something meaningful, to be someone who makes a lasting impact with what God's given you? Because there's a lot at stake here. We're not talking about playing church. We're talking about advancing the kingdom of God. We're talking about exposing people to the presence of Jesus and letting them see the body of Christ in action. I do know that God promises when his word goes out, it won't return empty, but will accomplish what he desires. And I do know we're not responsible, nor can we manipulate people's response to the gospel. And I know we're commissioned to serve people, to use what we've been given, to show people what God's love is like. So is this your day to decide who you were made to be with no fear, no safety first attitude, leaving the path of least resistance behind? It's your decision. And God, I want you to know, has already made his. Let's stand together and sing.